The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, it's February 24th, 2011. Brief explanation, we're running a few minutes late. We had a late Senate session, and to get everyone down to the basement here, we took a few extra minutes. But for our members' record, we'll be starting right back on time the next time we meet. Today we have Senator Pogemiller with Senate File 241. Welcome to the committee, Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
It's my first outing. Senate File 241 is a modest bill. It allows condominium owners to obtain copies of association records. Oh, and members, you should look at the A3 to delete everything. That'll be the language that I'm suggesting.
Senator Pogemiller, is this the first time you've presented your bill?
Yes. Yeah.
So this could be considered an author's amendment. Senator Pogemiller moves the eighth, or no,
Senator
someone
Scheid
else has
would.
To move it. Senator
yeah,
Scheid
Mr.
moves
Chairman.
The A3 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Mm-hmm. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chairman. So the bill is fairly straightforward. It allows condominium owners or people in condominiums to obtain copies of association records and clarifies access and costs for making those copies. And specifically confidentiality and cost employees' time. I was approached by a constituent who's had experience with this. We have talked with the Bar Association, some Bar Association lawyers, multi-housing, the realtors, and this A3 is where the language in that discussions with those various groups has resulted. This is not a, I want to make this clear, this is not a Bar Association bill, and apparently you have a vehicle that you usually work with them on. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in adding things to their bill.
That's fine.
Because apparently they have a very strong vetting process. It's a judiciary thing, I think.
Yeah, Senator Pogemiller, they just get a little touchy.
So this is not something that has been vetted through their entire process, but they had people in the bar who have worked in this area review this, and this is where the language ended up. Multi-housing has reviewed it and is satisfied to see that the employee time was included on line 1.19. Your console on line 0.118 and 1.22 is apparently where you are boilerplate-wise with recovery of costs for records and things through the Data Privacy Act, so that's language that was suggested by your console. So I think it's pretty straightforward. There's been one minor additional suggestion, and it's only if Senate counsel thinks this is clarifying. This was made by multi-housing. On line 113, instead of the word provide, perhaps say make available. And then on line 115, do the same where it says provide, put make available. They felt that was just a little better language.
Okay. Counsel, do you have any comments regarding the word, changing the word from provide to make available?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think it still works. I assume the thought was that, you know, electronic records, you may or may not actually be providing them. You just make them available. Or they might be online where somebody can just get access on their own.
Yeah, I think that was their thinking, yes.
Is there anyone here from the Multi-Housing Association, Minnesota Multi-Housing?
He is here. Yes, he is. We have more than he. We have the bar, too.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank
Could you,
Mr.
please
Chair.
Identify yourself for the record?
Sure. Todd Lilgenquist with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Also with me, Brian Lake with the Bar Association. We had talked about this suggestion. Ms. Pontius is correct. Two reasons. Number one, make available seems the different forms that it might be available if it's electronic wouldn't necessarily be provided. But also, for clarity's sake, up above it talks about line 0.1.11 and 1.12 that the record shall be made reasonably available. So for consistency's sake, rather than putting the burden on the owner or association management company to provide it, that they should be able to make it available rather than putting the burden on them to provide it. So I don't know if Mr. Lake has
I have a question for you. make available, what does that mean? Does that mean they can look at association documents in their office? Is that qualifying to make available? Or is it something that, the requester, the owner, actually can acquire and have a copy through either a Xerox copy, or they could pull it off an internet site and have it for their own possession? What does make available mean in this context?
Mr. Chair, to me, I think that as long as the requester has access to it, then that would be within the meaning of make available. So yes, an electronic form, if they were able to email it or look it up on their computer, you know, and disseminate it from the management company, that would be made available, or an actual hard copy or something along those lines. So it just seems the burden would be less on the provision of it and allow the management company to make it available. And again, for consistency's sake, I think it makes a little more sense.
Let me just make sure that we know what we're talking about, because if the person requesting this, the owner, went down to the association's office, some developments have an office, a management office, is making it available, is it making it available for their possession, or can they make available so they can peruse it in their office?
Chairman, I think if you look
Senator
at
Pogan-Miller.
Line 1.12.
Go ahead.
If you look at 1.12, it says reasonably available for examination and copying.
Okay. I see. The reason I'm asking this question is sometimes owners request a new copy of their bylaws and corporate declaration for the purpose of selling their unit. They have to have a copy to hand off to the buyer, who now the purchase agreement has been agreed on, but now it's time of essence. It has to be given to the buyer for a 10-day review. So I want to make sure that when we're talking of make available, it means that the person requesting the, or it's a, that person's agent has access to a hard copy some way. And is that the way you understand it? Mr. Lake?
Mr.
Could
Chair,
you
Brian,
identify yourself?
Brian Lake with the State Bar Association. We didn't have much time to review this language. I was able to send it to one of my one of our practitioners who specializes in this area. The concern that he expressed was the way the language was written seemed to suggest that the association would be responsible for making copies, and raised the scenario of, say, a small self-managed association, where if you had owners requesting copies, you could have a situation where the association president would then have to, you know, be running to Kinko's all the time to make copies. So we're certainly willing to continue working with Senator Pogan-Miller on language and working with you on language that would make you both more comfortable. But like I said, it was just kind of a quick review, and that was an issue that was raised.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question kind of related to yours. It has to do with the words on line 12 and copying, because it also preceded by shall be made reasonably available for examination, and that's pretty straightforward. And copying, does that mean I don't think you want me to walk in the office and say I'm going to take these to Kinko's and copy them. I don't think you want that situation. And it seems a little vague or ambiguous there about what that means, copying. I understand that the management firm could possibly make copies, as you say, or they may be really small and have to run to Kinko's to make the copies. But in any case, it looks like you might be able to walk in as a unit owner and say, I'd like to, you know, copy those and walk out with them. And I don't know. It may be the reasonably available covers that, but I'm not sure. So I wondered. I don't want to cause any trouble, because I know what you're trying to get at, and I think it's fine.
Yeah. Senator Pogan-Miller.
I wonder, It seems to me, with the combination of 112 and leaving the original language of must provide, it makes it clear that the owner should get this.
Right.
And it allows enough flexibility then for the management company to, all right, which way do I want to do that? Yeah. So I wonder if we shouldn't just leave the must provide. Seems like that gets it where you need it.
Senator Scheid, are you satisfied with?
Well, Mr. Chairman, no, it still leaves, that's still ambiguous, I think, on line 12. But, I mean, I know what we want to accomplish, but we don't want, I don't think they want the unit owners to walk in and walk out with the documents themselves to copy them.
Records.
So,
my experience has been that when someone requests it from an office or an association representative, there's no way that there's going to be an opportunity for someone to print a copy that immediate. These records are sometimes subject to change from year to year, sometimes month to month, as bylaws of the corporate association changes in its demands or services to the owners. And so that's why one needs to have, at least at certain times, a new copy, or a point of sale triggers a new copy by law. And so it's very difficult to assume that there would be a ready copy that's current available for the homeowner. So, Sarah Pogovin?
We think we might have figured out how to solve this. On 113, keep the word provide as in the amendment, but then change the word copies to records. Then I think if you read through that, it's pretty clear that you have to provide this, but it could be electronic or...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking that we could just take out and copying on line 12, because you further, you know, on line 13, you do say, I mean, you were going to say you must provide copies. But I just think there's some ambiguity on line 12 with and copying, and I'm being picky, I guess.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogovin.
Senator Scheid, I think the basic problem is apparently sometimes owners say, I would like this, and they say, okay, come on in whenever you're available and sit there and look through 200 pages. And that's the frustration. They would like to be able to get something that they can work with. So I think if you strike the word copying there, it puts you back maybe where someone could say, well, it's here. It's at the bank vault if you want to look at it someday, which is what we're trying to get over.
Senator Pogovin, thank you. Council, have you been following this discussion and the suggestion of that? Is anyone following this discussion?
It's a simple bit.
Mr. Chairman, members, perhaps, okay, try this. On page 1, line 12 of the amendment, delete the end copying. But then on line 13, before the period after statutes, insert comma, and upon request shall provide copies or make records reasonably, make records available for copying by the unit owner or the unit owner's or the authorized agent. And then I think it's already mentioned on lines 13, 15, and 17, delete the copies and insert records. I need to kind of look at that all together, but I think that's where the conversation was going.
Well, we're thinking of that, Senator Hoffman.
Seems that everything that gets in front of this committee gets confusing. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if, is there, I used to have a condo, so I kind of understand what's happening here. Is there any way that we could put, they'd make a request, and then within the next 2 weeks, they'd have the copies available, just so that they know, you know, that the condo owner would know that they have to do their diligence to get what they want, but that the copies would be available? Does that make any sense to anybody? Just Scott's giving me the no.
Senator Newman, did you want to weigh in on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hadn't intended to. I was just shaking my head at Senator Hoffman. I think the problem with putting in a time definite statement is there's going to be situations in which the owner isn't going to be able to comply. And to have language requiring them to be reasonable is pretty well accepted language, I think. So I'd be more comfortable with something that is reasonable as opposed to time sensitive.
Yeah. And Senator Hoffman, usually in these types of requests, usually anything to do with real estate or ownership, there's always a time of essence. There is a demand of time that needs to be recognized by parties, especially in points of sale. And that's another state law that it has to be provided within a specific time. So for the purposes of this bill, I don't think I'd want to get into the time factor that the existing law outside of sale points does not give an absolute time factor involved in it. I think over the recent history, it seems like that's been satisfactory. But let's get back to the language before us. Council, could you repeat that amendment, or are you giving it more contemplation?
Mr. Chairman, remember, on page 1, line 13, before the period, insert comma, "and upon request, the association shall provide copies or make, provide copies or make records available for copying by the owner or agent."
Can I ask a question right now? By making a record available for copying, that changes the demand on the provider of that document. That means you can take the original and give it to them, and then the requester goes out and copies it. I don't think we want to do that.
Mr. Chairman, you're right. That was my impression, was that was one of the issues that was being discussed, or else that they'd be like electronic access where they just give them a site they could go to and get in with an ID, or it would be on the internet or
then,
something.
So then provide electronic records available for copy.
Back to the original language. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogamiller.
Your office, I mean, we did have a lot of lawyers look at this, and I'm starting to get back to the original language now as we go in this circle. Because this is what they were all kind of working with, to clarify the statute, but do it in a way that was not onerous on the association. And as I go back to the original language, maybe changing the word copies on 113 and on 115 to records, I think gets people where they want to be. Just listening to members. And I agree with Senator Newman's comment that the time frame could get onerous, maybe. You want what's happening out there apparently is that it's a reasonableness question, and sometimes the associations just don't appear to be as reasonable to the owner as they should be. Because a fairly sizable townhouse condominium association, they're going to have electronic records. If you got 82 units, my guess is you're going to have electronic records. Because most condos now, they pay their fees online.
Senator Pogamiller, maybe I can explain to you my experience with some associations. I've been dealing with a lot of retired people in order to sell. I'm a real estate agent. And in selling a townhouse, sometimes some owners don't keep real good records. They don't know where that association documents are from 14 years back when they bought it. The association has changed some rules. They need to provide for the point of sale a recent up-to-date copy so that the new buyer can review bylaws and documents. Sometimes some associations are rather small in their number of pages. Some are rather large. I've seen some that go 150 to 200 pages. But 200 pages may cost, a reasonable cost might be a dime a piece. So you got $20 worth of hard costs.
Yeah, that's
and maybe an hour worth of labor for someone to go down to a Kinko's and get it printed. But what's happening is associations are charging up to $300-$400 for that $20 copy cost, and some are turning it into a revenue maker, and they're doing it when the owner of the association is actually asking for their own copies. And so that's part of the problem that I think you're trying to address, but also the reasonableness of keeping the cost reasonable and realistic. There are some people that don't have electronic means to transmit documents, especially our elderly, that kind of have, they won't go to the internet world. And so they don't have means to draw it from an electronic record and print their own documents. So the amendment was kind of created to give it, to cover just a few extra things as it was going through the Judiciary Committee.
Let me, Mr. Chairman, let me propose we stay with the original language except for on 113 and 115, change the word copies to records.
Records.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Pogemiller, could you repeat the reference on the copying to records?
On line 113, the last word copies.
Yep.
Put in records. And on 115, not required to provide copies, make that provide records. So you're not required to provide records in electronic form if you don't keep them in electronic form, which seems reasonable.
Any questions on that language? Senator Schein?
Well, Mr. Chairman, do you see where it says copying by any unit owner? Does that how anybody else reads it? I mean, it might be small, but it still seems that somebody could come in and say, look, the law says I can make copies of this. And if I'm going to make copies, you're going to have to give me the original or make a copy so that I can go make a copy. I mean, I think you can have, I understand the need for people to have copies, to get copies. I just don't think that you want to say it, that they have the right to make the copies.
No, she's seeking by any unit.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator
Scheid? If you read the whole sentence, so it says available for examination and copying. And the answer to that is I want a copy. I want you to give me the originals for a copy. You just say, no, I'm going to give you the examination part. Here's an electronic version, or here's another copy. So I don't think it forces them to give you the records.
No. Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman,
are you working off the A3 amendment or the original language?
Yes, I'm looking at the A3, and it's actually in both.
Okay. Senator Pogemiller, as for the purposes of this discussion, you had suggested to go back to the original language of the original bill.
No, the original A3.
The A3. Okay.
Yeah, A3. Oh, the original A3.
I'm off then. All right. And records.
Well, how about changing on 112, Senator Scheid, Mr. Chairman, instead of examination and copying, why don't you say examination or copying?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Senator Scheid? I don't know who said that, but Senator Scheid, what do you think of it?
What did they say? I don't want to make a bigger deal out of it because I know what you mean. I'm looking at what it says, and I think an owner might walk in and say, look, I can go and copy this.
Okay.
And the law says you have to let me copy it. But I don't think you need copying on that line, but that's fine. That's fine.
Senator Scheid, I tend to agree with you, but let's ask Ms. Pontius if what would be the effect of either taking out and copying or changing it to or records.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think we'll change in the end to or. I don't think would do anything. I understand Senator Scheid's literal reading of the language where somebody could say it has to be available for copying, although you could argue, well, but then you look further in the language and it's pretty clear that it's the association that's doing the copying.
It covers it. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm wondering if you just change it to or for examination or copies. Then it wouldn't say they could take a. Wouldn't that cover it?
Ms. Pontius, do you have any?
Mr. Chairman, I think you still have the problem. It's either like the or would be either examination by the unit owner or it would be copying by the unit owner, which I think is where Senator Scheid's issue is. So I don't think that would take care of that concern. That was the alternative. Well, you could either just delete the reference to end copying because the rest of the language pretty clearly talks about the person's ability to get copies. Right. So.
True. Right.
Sir Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For what it's worth, I agree with Senator Scheid. I think that the words "and copying" on line 112 are superfluous. Clearly, without that language, there is a right to examine the records. Mm-hmm. And even more clearly, beginning on line 13, there is the method by which the individual has a right to obtain the records and get them copied. So my suggestion would be to simply remove the words "and copying," and I think it clarifies the bill and would remove any questions that Senator Scheid has. And I think the bill would be fine. I really do.
Senator Newman moves an oral amendment to remove the underlined words "and copying" from line 112. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. The A3 amendment is before us. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, do we have, how does that line 113 read then, the new language?
We haven't made any other changes
so
to the original
the
language.
So the association must provide copies in paper or, okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Goodwin.
I happen to have a constituent here who was here on another issue, but he's a townhouse owner and a president of the association, and I just wonder before we vote on the amendment if he would like to speak to it. Mr. Emmy?
Sure. Thanks. No, Mr. Chairman, the danger of one-page bills.
Welcome to the committee. You've been drafted.
No problem. This will be quick. I got to bust the catch.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mark Emmy.
And Mr. Emmy, where do you live?
Columbia Heights.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
I just want to say that I'm very happy to see this language here. I had an incident about 4 years ago with my association where I requested a copy of a document, the type of thing you're addressing here. And in order for them to provide it, they insisted that I had to go to the office of the property manager. The property manager is in Maple Grove, which is not really adjacent to Columbia Heights.
It's just
Sherman's community.
Yeah. And the property manager kept business hours, you know, 8 to 4, which most people are working. So not only were they inconveniencing me, telling me I had to go to the property manager, they were basically saying I had to take time off of my work to do so. And again, at that point in time, I just capitulated. I wasn't about to spend that much for the document that I wanted, and I just let it slide. So I'm, like I say, very, very happy to see this language here. I think it is needed. And as far as the rest of it, addressing the cost and stuff, I think that is very reasonable as well, because I know from personal experience that there are property management associations out there that any of these costs or any of these documents you're requesting, they are using them as revenue generators. They are charging well and above and beyond what it costs to produce. Not only copies, but in particular, the REIT sale disclosure agreement that you have to have when you want to sell your unit.
Yep.
I was a property manager for 4.5 years, so I know how much work it takes to fill one of those out. Half hour, most of the time, tops. And a lot of property management companies charge $150 to $200. I wish I was in a position where I was getting that kind of pay on an hourly basis. So that's basically all I wanted to say.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Emmy. Any further discussion on the bill? Mayor Scheid?
Then I'd move, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 41 as amended be recommended to pass.
And I believe it goes to the floor.
I think so.
Getting the nod, yes. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr.
Thank
Chairman,
you, Senator.
Thank you. It's good
Pogemon.
To see the Judiciary Committee is maintaining its historical thoroughness.
Come back soon. We'll be waiting. The next order of business is a further discussion with our new Department of Corrections Commissioner, Tom Roy. And he'll be today giving us a little bit more of an overview of how the budget overview of the Department of Corrections is in. Welcome, Commissioner, back to the committee. Before we begin, Senator Lance.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. While they're getting prepared, if I might inquire, we are about 1 month away from the Senate deadline for passing budgets out.
That's correct.
And I wonder if the chair could give the committee some guidance as to how you intend to proceed, how you see the schedule in our committee work in the next month, and when we anticipate getting a budget for this jurisdiction.
General
Lance,
that's a great question. Right now, we only have the governor's proposal. We haven't seen the exact details. Well, yes, we have seen the exact cost runs on it. The schematics. The majority party is still finishing up their details on their proposal. Once they have that before us, we will be examining the agencies that are in our jurisdiction and continuing to understand their exact status in light of where their budget is and where it might be going. We could go in the reference of the governor's proposal and how that would relate to the agencies. Eventually, we'll be looking at it from the perspective of a majority party budget proposal. And then we'll be, as we shake through all of that discussion, we'll be creating our own budget. If there's times when there are policy discussions or bills before us, we will be using our time to that purpose as well. But keep in mind, we're going to try and stay away from those that are going to trigger any excessive costs. If they're nominal, we'll consider them, but anything of any major import, we will be holding until we get a budget kind of ironed together.
Mr. Chairman, just
the moving target.
Can you give us some idea of when you anticipate that we'll see the majority party's budget, since the governor can propose, but we're the ones that have to pass the legislation?
Senator Latz, I have not been given an exact date of when that would be finished. So as soon as I know, I'll let you know. Okay. Welcome back, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Senator, Mr. Chair, committee members. To my left, Assistant Commissioner Lisa Ogrosky, and to my right, Deputy Commissioner David Criss. We have worked in concert on this presentation, and we hope to present some information to you that will help you in your important work. We are going to share in this presentation, and we're going to be very cognizant of your time constraints, and hopefully our presentation will be as efficient as possible. Clearly, public safety is an issue that is a concern to all of us. Your words last week were indicated to me that you have a keen interest in public safety as well. So our presentation will be somewhat redundant for the first few slides, and we hope that it forms a base for our further discussion. Very quickly, clearly, public safety in Minnesota has been philosophically oriented to locking up the most serious, dangerous offenders, and we have used a model for community supervision for those less serious. We, in all of our efforts in order to reduce recidivism, we want offenders to leave our care and control better citizens. So we always have a very keen interest in making them better citizens and more productive citizens. And we can never lose sight of the victims, because the victims certainly are those that feel the pain most of crime. And our efforts always have to be oriented to those important victim issues. Continuing a little bit on our discussion last week, we again want to remind committee members that Minnesota is postured very well in terms of cost, and also very specifically related to cost is the employee workforce. We are 47th in correctional workers as a part of the state correctional workforce, ranked amongst the states. And clearly we all know the cost of personnel these days and how important that is. The fourth slide relates to and very clearly demonstrates again what we talked about last week, in that Minnesota's model amongst states that are similarly populated, our prison population is very, very low, ranked 49th amongst the 50, and hence related costs to prisons are minimal. And the next slide again gets back to that Wisconsin comparison. State populations very similar, prison inmates extraordinarily different, and also adult probation and parole numbers extraordinarily different. And these two lines really speak to the philosophy of Minnesota corrections, in that we rely heavily on probation, parole, and community supervision with the partners that we talked about last week, community corrections in our county.
Commissioner?
Yes.
Could I interrupt? I couldn't help but notice this reference to Green Bay Packers team on page 5. Are you a supporter of the Green Bay Packer team?
Mr. Chair, Senators,
Steelers.
I'm a hockey fan, actually.
Don't run for office.
Well, Mr. Chair,
yes.
That begs a question.
Yeah.
Is there another team in this area?
Ooh, okay. Proceed.
Thank you. Also, as we discussed last week, the budget comparison between the two states is significant, and prisons cost a lot of money. Wisconsin clearly is realizing that. And when you look at the number of state adult facilities, clearly the costs are related to those. And the cost per citizen for correction spending is very significant, and people in Minnesota should be very confident that they are getting a good deal and a good bang for the buck for their corrections money.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, point of clarification, when we see the number of inmates, 22,000 versus 9 to our neighbors, are they counting county inmates over there?
That statistic is related, Mr. Chair, Senator, that statistic is related to prison populations.
Strictly state prison, not counties.
Yes.
Commissioner, while we're on this question, does it include those that might be on parole, or is it strictly prison inmates?
These are strictly prison in custody statistics.
All right. Thank you. Mr.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Latz.
Just to follow up on Senator Ingebrigtsen's question, then, do we know what the comparable numbers are, including the county workhouses?
We know that in Minnesota, Mr. Chair, Senator, we know that in Minnesota we have about 9,000 to 10,000 offenders in county and community corrections facilities in addition to our prison population. I cannot speak to the Wisconsin numbers.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
it might be helpful to flesh out the comparison if we could obtain the Wisconsin numbers. I mean, if they're incarcerated somewhere, but just a matter of who owns the facility, it's a different question than if they're not incarcerated at all and they're really truly out in the community. Mr. Chairman, just a parenthetical thought. It looks like we are, our system is set up in a way that is very cost efficient right now. Perhaps we could send a letter of recommendation over to the Wisconsin governor and legislature. They could fix part of their budget problem without maybe get past the impasse
we
at the
We really want to get into this, Senator.
Just trying to help our neighboring taxpayers save some money without any compromise in public safety, because as we heard last time, we have the same results with regard to effectiveness in public safety as Wisconsin does.
Please proceed, Commissioner.
Thank you. And Mr. Crist will take over the next portion here.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is David Crist. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division of the Department. Just want to run through a few quick facts about the department. We've got about 4,200 FTEs in the department. The governor is proposing a fiscal 12-13 budget of about $915 million. We are incarcerating about 9,600 adult offenders and 133 juveniles. We've got a churn of offenders who come into our system. There's offenders that are admitted every day. There's offenders that are released every day. And when we count all of the bodies that go through that process, it's about 1,600 offenders every year that go through our 8 adult facilities and 2 juvenile facilities. We are caretakers for 6 million square feet of interior property in the department, and if you set aside the colleges and universities, that's the most square feet of any state department. In the DOC Community Supervision Field Services Unit oversees 20,000 offenders. Prison populations in Minnesota rose pretty dramatically between 2000 and 2005, but they've leveled off fairly well in the past 5 years, and for the next 5 years, we project that the populations will not be increasing very dramatically either. So who do we have in prison? Well, they're all convicted felony offenders. They've all been sentenced to at least a minimum sentence of 1 year and 1 day. They average 7 prior convictions, 3 prior felony convictions, and as prescribed by statutes and the guidelines, except for lifers and some certain sex offenders, our offenders serve 2/3 of their time in prison and 1/3 of their time in the community on supervision. This chart gives a quick breakdown of the kind of offenders that we've got. We lock up the most serious offenders. We lock up the people that we're afraid of in Minnesota. So 51% of our offenders are in for a personal offense.
And I will, Mr. Chair, take slide number 10 here.
Pardon me, Commissioner. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could go back to page 8. On your slide, seven average prior convictions, 3 average felony convictions. I'm thinking about the comparison that you were earlier making, Mr. Commissioner, to Wisconsin. Does Wisconsin maybe have more folks in prison because they incarcerate before Minnesota does? You know, we're looking at folks in prison right now of 7. Average prior conviction strikes me as being quite a lot.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Commissioner.
I wish I could speak more knowledgeably about the sentencing practice in Wisconsin, and I can't.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Could you then just to extrapolate a little bit more on the seven average prior convictions, three average felony? What are you talking about there? I mean, just explain it to me a little bit, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the sentencing guidelines controls felony sentences in Minnesota, and I know you folks are familiar with those. And the reason why these priors are indicated so high for our inmates in our facilities is that a important feature of the guidelines is criminal history. It's the level of offense and criminal history are the two main elements. It's like a wind chill chart. So the colder it is and the higher the wind is blowing, that wind chill factor goes up. A very similar analysis. The more severe crime a person commits with a more significant history, they will quickly fall in the commitment to prison area of the sentencing guidelines. So it's highly unlikely that anybody will end up in prison that does not have a profile like this. You need a pretty significant criminal history for the middle ranking of crimes in order to end up in prison. There are certainly crimes that are very severe that only with one or two prior convictions you will find yourself in prison. But this profile is pretty common for the vast majority of our inmates.
Mr. Chairman, one quick.
Senator Newman.
Then I'll be quiet. Commissioner, the seven average prior convictions would then include misdemeanors. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I heard your comment that the people that we are most afraid of are being incarcerated. But I just want to challenge that. I think we have many in the civil commitment system that I wouldn't want back on the street, the sex offenders who have converted from one system to the other. I'm not sure we properly sentence those folks in the first place. And I'm wondering if you're looking at that and if you're going to be proposing any changes to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I need a little, perhaps a little more clarification on the sex offender reference you just made.
Well, Mr. Chair, we move folks into civil commitment if they are still believed to be a danger after their sentence is completed. And I think that's the wrong answer. It seems to me that and no one's coming out. They're not being released because their treatment providers still believe they are a risk to the community. So I think we have a fundamental problem in the way we are managing their sentence. And I'm wondering if you are looking at that, if you are intending to make recommendations. I know they are housed in a separate department or managed by a separate department. I still don't understand that part. But I don't think that we want those folks ever back on the street. And I don't think their sentences I don't think the range of sentence opportunity there is long enough for our judges when we see the violent offenses that these folks have committed, and then they're being at least considered for release.
Senator, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Commissioner.
Thank you for that clarification, and this is day 19 on the job for me, and not one day has gone by that I haven't had this issue raised in some venue. It is clearly of interest to our department in terms of managing sex offenders in our facilities. We are engaged at the end of confinement with an assessment of those offenders that you just referenced, so we do have an important part in that. The ultimate decision to civilly commit, of course, lies with the county attorneys and the judges engaged in that process and the housing, as you correctly stated, in another department. I think we all have an investment in that process. As a new member of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, I know that it will be brought up with the commission as well. This issue is not going away. It's an issue that we are all stumbling over, and you correctly stated many of the features of the dynamic that is frustrating for a lot of people. The treatment of sex offenders, the relatively low risk of some offenders and the relatively high risk of some sex offenders. Weighing those and the assumption of risk for release planning is clearly an issue that I have to deal with. And I'm not prepared to say today what that solution will be, but I can assure you that it is high on our priority list. And again, there's not a day that's gone by that I haven't had some consideration of it.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, we need very strong leadership on this issue. We need you to work with the Commissioner for the Health and Human Services Department and make a strong recommendation to us about, and to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, about expanding the range of potential sentences for these violent offenders. Because what's happening now, we've constructed around the problem instead of addressing the problem. We've had sort of fixes on this issue for many years. I've had very strong concerns about the constitutionality of folks that get put into placement in a civil commitment and never come out. We've never had anyone yet. We've got a couple that are being considered for release, but they never come out. So I have constitutional concerns about the way we're managing those folks. And so I would request that you and the commissioner figure out how do we expand the sentencing guidelines and then go back with a very strong recommendation to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission that they take that up immediately. It is a pressing concern, as you yourself have identified. I don't know anybody that doesn't care about this issue. So we are looking to you for strong leadership, and I would appreciate your partnership here with legislators to begin to address this head-on instead of around the issue.
Senator Ortman, we, too, in the legislature have a responsibility of making policy in this direction, too. And I think what we'll have to do is rely on the experts at Department of Corrections to give us guidance as we try to make policies. I know a number of legislators have a few proposals themselves, and we will be addressing this year. And so we'll need everyone's help on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Especially yours.
We're ready to go.
All
thank
right.
you.
Please proceed, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The previous pie chart on slide number 9 showed us the inmate offense profile. This particular slide shows us those offenders who are under community supervision in the state. And you can see here a reflection of the philosophy where in the previous slide, 51% of people in prison are personal offenses and only 22% of those in the community are person offenses. And that's really the effect of guidelines. We use the word unique on this next slide, and I'm not sure these are totally unique to the Department of Corrections. Again, public safety is core responsibility of government. We are unique and similar to other public safety entities in that we are a 24/7, 365-day-a-year service delivery system. Our prisons don't close on weekends. Our probation officers may go home at night, but believe me, the phones still ring and they still respond to issues in the community. We don't control the flow of clients and offenders that come to us. We serve those that come through the law enforcement community. They start the process with arrest, of course, going through the court system. And if the judge says Department of Corrections take care of this offender, we have to take care of this offender. We are a general fund organization. And we talked last week, of course, about the three delivery system. The fact that we have partners in the community corrections and counties is very important to us, especially since we support the model of community supervision. We, in the olden days, often had a lot of grant money. We are no longer the recipients of large grants. We still get some correctional fees from offenders, but nothing substantial that we can count on into the future. Assistant Commissioner Lisa Ogrosky will help us through the next slides.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Lisa Ogrosky, Assistant Commissioner of Operations Support. The first slide we have, we did show you in our overview, and it's a historical perspective of budget reductions we've taken since 2002. I'm not going to go over them in detail as we did that last time. These are very specific programmatic reductions. And I will also comment at the same time, as our offender population was increasing, we were receiving base adjustments to help fund that increased offender population. The next slide shows the governor's recommendation, a biennial budget of $915 million. Of this budget, almost 72% is for correctional facilities, 4.5% is for operations support. The DOC community services portion is 8.5%. And then funding out to our community partners through pass-through and subsidies is 15.3% of our budget. On page 5 of your budget book, it shows a general fund increase of 2.4%. However, that figure doesn't tell the whole story.
Pardon me, Senator
Jungbauer.
Jungbauer.
See, now I'm confused here. If you back up with slide, I just have a question. 2002-2003, when you talk about a per diem reduction plan, I just want clarification in terms of did we, the legislature, say that the per diem, did we reduce the per diem, or did we talk about across-the-board cuts in terms of percentages that then were applied to that per diem, or how did that work in terms of a per diem reduction?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer,
Ms. Ogrosky.
Actually, this was a self-imposed per diem reduction plan. It wasn't anything the legislature had done.
Okay.
Previous commissioner, even prior to Commissioner Fabian, Cheryl Ramstead-Voss, paid a lot of attention to per diems and saw that Minnesota was one of the higher per diems in the nation. And we hired a private consultant to come in and give us advice on staffing levels, staffing ratios, how many supervisors to employees, those types of things. And the agency itself came up with a per diem reduction plan. We had done this before some of the budget issues came with those sessions, I believe it was like the 2002 session, when even additional cuts were imposed on the agency.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Ogrosky. Then, so the 200 positions that were eliminated, what kinds of positions, so that we understand ramifications to these things?
Ms. Ogrosky, could you pull your microphone closer?
A little closer? Thank you.
Yeah. That's better.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, there are a variety of positions. A lot of them were supervisory positions. Some of them we had legal assistants, for example, at each of the facilities. We have a rather litigious population, so we did have, like, legal assistants. Those positions went away. We reduced the number of security captains at a couple of facilities, some of the correctional program staff. Mr. Chris may have a good memory, too, as he worked in a facility at that time, so he may have a few to add.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, she's named many of the positions. We reduced a few lieutenants. We reduced, got rid of all of the assistants to the wardens that we had in the facilities at the time. We eliminated the position of security director in our facilities, and there were a couple of facilities, as she said, that had more than one captain that went down to one captain at that time. So that's a pretty good overview.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ogrosky, or whoever could answer this, you mentioned that we have a rather litigious population. Have we ever done any evaluation as to the cost of that, whether or not there was any real value, or what the percentage of value litigations were there, or if they were more frivolous, just to impose a cost on the system? And is there anything we can do in terms of that cost? I mean, I've seen that referred to many times, but never seen it compared to other states, or whether they were frivolous lawsuits or valuable lawsuits. I mean, we don't want to discourage folks from filing valuable lawsuits that would help them in the end, but is there any studies on that type of thing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, there's federal laws related to litigation that gets into the federal courts that in the last few years have made it more difficult for offenders to bring frivolous lawsuits. And so we've got that on our side. In addition, we've got just a general philosophy in the department that we're going to aggressively litigate against those things that we think are frivolous. By doing that, we do believe it has a deterrent effect on the offender that might want to simply litigate for the entertainment value of that or just to make our lives miserable or to maliciously increase cost. So we think that that works.
Great. Thank you. That was a great answer.
Okay. Please proceed.
As I was saying in your budget book, it does state that we have a 2.4% increase in general fund dollars. We do have a change item about federal stimulus money and money we received. And the biennial budget pages for fiscal years 10 and 11 don't reflect what our actual base budget should have been. So truly, we are taking a 1.7% reduction in general funding. And I will talk about that federal stimulus next. Our first budget recommendation is an increase in our budget of $26.9 million for the biennium. In fiscal year 2010, we were requested by Minnesota Management and Budget to utilize federal stimulus money in the amount of $38 million, and we were told that our budget would be restored. So our budget was decreased on the general fund side by $38 million, and we received $38 million in federal stimulus money. In fiscal year 11, our base budget was fully restored with general fund money. However, the tails for fiscal years 12 and 13 were not fully restored. They were shorted $13.4 million each year. This is core base funding the agency needs to continue operations. It's money we've relied on. Just for equivalent factors, it's about 200 positions and also equates to about half of the St. Cloud prison budget.
Ms. Ogrowski, this $13 million per year, when you round it up, it's nearly $27 million. Is that directly attributable to the reliance on the one-time stimulus money from the year before? And that they didn't create a the powers that were did not create a plan in order to fund it this coming year or biennium?
Mr. Chair.
How did we get into this?
How did we get into this situation? That's a very good question. And Mr. Turner might be able to help me out a little bit with this, too. It was during conference committee that this issue occurred, so it was very last minute. The cut to the agency budget, it said operating reduction on the line for fiscal year 10. And when the tails went out into 12 and 13, there wasn't any programmatic recommendation. You know, it didn't say cut your budget and do this. It was just a reduction in the tails. We were fully reliant on general fund money. You know, we thought this was going to be, you know, use this $38 million in stimulus because MMB had it and needed to use it, and then, you know, we did get our money back that subsequent next year. It's just the tails got messed up.
Mr. Turner, did you have any more detail to reflect on this? I don't know if all our members are aware of the unique financial problem that the Department of Corrections has as a result of this.
Mr.
I know
Chairman.
You and I have had discussion about it, but I'm not sure if all our members have. Could you augment us a little bit on this?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members. Unfortunately, we went into this with our eyes wide open. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, the federal stimulus came. The decision was made to fund the first year of the biennium in correctional institutions. Second year, they were fully funded with Minnesota General Fund dollars. And then we had a tails target. And we were directed to not fully restore the $38 million, and with the understanding that it would be revisited, and now we're revisiting it, and we're paying the piper.
Okay.
Let me ask a question. How does $27 million affect your budget? Roughly, I think that's, what, 8% of your total budget, or give or take a million or so. But it's rather significant, especially when you don't have very many options.
Mr. Chair,
I don't think anybody wants to open any cell doors early.
Mr. Chair, this is very significant to our budget, and it's very, very concerning to us. If we don't get this funding, I'm not, you know, it equates to, if you take all of our sex offender treatment, all of our chemical dependency treatment, and almost all of our education, it might come up to $13 million a year. So this is not a small dollar amount for us. It's very, very substantial.
Okay. Please continue. Senator Newman has a question first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a request, if you could. It says without this funding, core activities will be impacted. And just a request, perhaps you could provide us with a list of what core activities you're talking about will be impacted, what core activities will not be impacted. And when you say impacted, you know, are you saying that these activities are going to be cut, modified, reduced? I would ask for some information on what you mean by impacted. And you don't have to do it now. I would frankly prefer a list rather than oral testimony.
Senator Newman, one thing that you might want to consider, and I was just given a figure, 1 year of operating the Rush City Prison equals about $27 million to run it. So a half a year of running one of our major prisons is equal to $27 million or a biennium worth. And how many prisoners are in Rush City?
900 or so. Mr. Chairman, members, close to 1,000.
Okay. So it's significant dollar figure. So we'll be examining this as we proceed with our budget struggles this session. But please continue. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question so I understand. That $38 million in federal funding was 2010-11 fiscal year. It was all in 1 year. So, in effect, the 13.5 is about a third of what was. In other words, you're going backwards by about 20-some million a year from where you were last year, current fiscal year.
Ms. Ogrowski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, no, we would be going back to $13.4 million each year. The federal stimulus money was fully restored the second year of last biennium. So, like, for fiscal year 11, our base budget is whole based on that stimulus. It's in the out years, it's $13.4 million that we're short.
Mr. Chair, you're short by $13.4, or that's what was appropriated to fill in for the $38 million gap?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, we've been shorted. In the next, in 12 and 13 each year, we are short $13.4 million.
Okay.
Please continue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the next change item relates to chemical dependency treatment at the Faribault facility. A couple of years ago, we were fortunate enough to get a federal grant through the Department of Justice to double the number of chemical dependency treatment beds at Faribault from 90 beds to 180 beds. What this change initiative would do is to continue that funding after the grant runs out on December 31st of this year. Without this funding, we'll go back to the 90-bed level at that facility, and 90 beds amounts to 10% of all of the chemical dependency treatment capacity that we have in the department. I want to note also that we've got studies that show that chemical dependency treatment works. A study of recidivism after 3 years shows that those that participate in the treatment recidivate at a level that's 27% less than others. So this really gets to be a public safety issue.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Next, we're going to cover our budget reductions. Our first reduction is an operating budget reduction. When we looked at our budget, we, of course, put our highest priority on focusing, maintaining some of our services. We have been able to reduce expenditures and positions in each division. We've looked at all of our vacancies, and we've actually are planning on eliminating positions from some employees who took care of an early retirement incentive that was passed last year. We are going to be eliminating 14 positions, and there's a few in each division: community services, the facilities division, and operations support.
These new next two slides are probably the most significant impact to our community partners and certainly to our department as well. And I'm sure, Senators, you will be hearing from our partners about these reductions. The philosophy behind these reductions is that all partners should share in the pain to a degree if, in fact, we are in a budget reduction mode. We were very thoughtful and recognized that we couldn't put the total burden on our community corrections or county partners, and that our Department of Corrections as well had to be impacted by these reductions. And across those three delivery systems, 2.5%. The next slide, number 20, shows on the bottom right the amounts related to each of those delivery systems. And the most important bullet on this page is the bottom one, that the total reduction to all delivery systems is equivalent to about 22 supervision officers, affecting supervision of 1,500 to 2,000 offenders. We're not suggesting that community corrections or our county partners would, in fact, reduce supervision staff. They may have other strategies within their own departments that would deal with the reduction in the pass-through money to those divisions. But I think it's always important that we present to you some sense of impact and, in terms of real bodies, what these reductions would mean. And we are very cognizant of the importance of our partners, and we're very sensitive to this issue. In our presentation to the House this morning, they were very concerned about these reductions because, similar to our presentation here last week, we told you that community supervision is really part of how we do business in Minnesota. So they questioned the strategy, and we made ourselves available for alternatives. And being a former director of a community corrections agency, I am especially sensitive to this issue as well.
Commissioner, on that last slide, the last bullet point, total reduction equivalent to approximately 22 supervision agents with a combined caseload of 1,500 to 2,000 offenders. If one went that route, what happens to those 1,500 to 2,000 offenders? Who oversees it? Do we pull them? How does this system work with that supervision reduction?
Mr. Chair, an excellent question, and it relates back to our discussion last week about risk assessment, if you recall that discussion. If, in fact, this was the only strategy, was a reduction in supervising officers, we would hope that each agency would closely look at the workload risk assessment numbers that they have, and that these 1,500 or 2,000 offenders would be absolutely the lowest risk offenders that they have in their departments. We would hope that would be the strategy. That is already occurring in many agencies. In the agency that I left, we had caseloads for minimum supervision offenders. Some of those caseloads were 500 or 600 per officer. And we knew that the statistics would prove to us that, based on our risk assessment, it was unlikely that those offenders would come back into our have attention with us. And I think we have moved along so far in best practices that across the state, I think probation agencies recognize that reducing supervision to low-risk offenders is a reasonable strategy.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, when you said some of the low-risk ones have 400 or 500 people in their caseload, I mean, that's not very frequent supervision. I mean, it might be soon becoming unsupervised release. But where, I mean, you worked in community corrections for a long time. What's happened to caseload, say, over the last decade? Overall, I mean, I know with the serious, not, I mean, you're talking averages, I'm sure, but generally, has it been a significant reduction, or has it been just sort of a gradual, slow thing, or?
Mr. Chair. Sure. Senator, the Minnesota has benefited more so than other Southern Belt states, Arizona, Texas, Florida, California, all those states have seen dramatic, dramatic increases in offender numbers. Our demographics have leveled out to a degree. And while they have increased in some areas with new laws, for instance, our felony DWIs, our lifetime supervision of some offenders now, gradually those caseloads and workloads will increase. But relatively, we are in pretty good shape. But with the reductions in 2003, we have what has resulted from some of those reductions are those large 400 or 500 caseloads. And it's an assumption of risk is what it comes down to at the end of the day. And we hope we make good decisions about that, and that really, truly, the lowest risk offenders are on those large caseloads.
Please continue.
There is a reduction to one specific program in our to our friends in Dodge, Fillmore, Olmsted, and this is a Community Corrections Act jurisdiction, and this is a pilot project that we talked about, and it is a reduction to that project very specifically, and it is the only one of its nature in the state right now. And we are very pleased, and we actually had conversation with the director this morning, and obviously these folks in DFO are not happy about this, but they recognize the unique situation that we are all in at this point. We are pleased to be at the end of our presentation. I know that you're going to have some questions. We are, and I have been in this new position, quite amazed that this budget strategy from the governor's office is really as simple as it is. I mean, I have seen these types of presentations go on for hours and hours, and I don't anticipate that, but it could certainly happen. But with five major points, we think it's something that we can support. And I've already talked about our impact on our community friends, but I think everybody's recognizing that the pain is going to be significant, and it could be greater than these proposals as well. All right. We recognize that.
Any questions for the commissioner? Yes, Senator Harrington.
Mr. Roy, Mr. Chairman, I have two questions. One, doesn't this budget really not only does it not move us forward in adopting best practices, doesn't it take us backwards in terms of the staff to offender ratio and eliminate the programs that are really the most effective?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator, quite frankly, yes.
So what you're telling me is we're not working smarter, we're going to work harder, but we're going to have less people to do the work.
Commissioner.
Senator, we have been in that status for any number of years, and it since 2003 that has been the status, and we would like to, for instance, expand drug courts, expand our treatment numbers of sex offenders. We certainly would like to do that, but we recognize fiscal reality, and but you clearly are aware of programs that, if they are properly staffed, if they have the intensity of service, we get great results. You're absolutely right.
And in your context, great results actually mean that citizens in the state of Minnesota are safer, which to me the converse means that if we're not doing the right things, we are in fact passing a budget that makes the citizens of Minnesota less safe.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, anytime we don't give the proper services to offenders at the right dosage, anytime that we don't specifically get the right people in the right programs, recidivism rates go up. You're absolutely correct. And as a result of that, certainly crime rates go up.
My second question, if I may, one more question, is in looking at your numbers, the other piece that strikes me is when you talk about this is going to increase the ratio, are you really just talking about the ratio between of state felony level offenses? Does your numbers include the misdemeanor offenses that are coming out of the workhouse that is also going to be handed to the county probation officers, or is that a separate item?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, all levels of offenders would be impacted by those reductions if, in fact, it is a supervision reduction strategy. And we fully recognize there are serious misdemeanor offenders that impact the health of the community. Our domestic abuse cases are misdemeanor assault cases. Street crime typically is misdemeanor crime, and you're very familiar with that. And as supervision ratios go up, supervision of those offenders is less. You're absolutely correct.
I will just end with this one comment. The success that we've seen in some areas has really been a combination of providing good services for victims, especially, for example, in domestic assault, but also in holding offenders accountable. I think if we do not hold offenders accountable, we lose that thin blue line, or that thin line between the sheep and the wolves. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to echo some of those same concerns, I had to step out, and I'm sorry I did, but the 24/7 operation thing, I think, a lot of times gets overlooked by a lot of people. And I bring that experience to this committee in building a jail or trying to build a jail a couple different times, and people don't realize what that means. Yes, they know you're open, but they don't realize that your facility wears out three times faster than everybody else's. MnDOT's facility is only open for 8 hours. Courts are only open for 8 hours. These things are running to the ground 24/7. So a 30-year building, average normal building, is really and truly a 90-year building. So when you see that that being said, and I know we've looked at cutting and slicing budgets here over the last couple of years, and we have to be mindful of that we have to allow these people to work in a safe environment, and that's one of the things that we have to be mindful of. These folks that we lock up, in our state, are especially the dangerous ones, need attention, and the more staff we cut, the less attention and the more mischievous those folks are going to be, and they're going to cause problems. And I know maybe you didn't even talk about the amount of assaults that are going on in the prison system now to the correctional officers, but I know that's been increasing as well. So we all have to be mindful of that when we move ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, thank you for raising that point. Christ. We've got two facilities that are almost 125 years old now, St. Cloud and Red Wing. Stillwater is going to be 100 years old in 3 years. So we put a lot of effort, and Senator Newman, that's one of the core functions that we do is maintain these these buildings. We put a lot of effort into that so that the taxpayer gets a good bang for the buck just in terms of the physical plant that we operate. Thanks also for raising the topic of the climate of the facilities as well. Our prison programming got to the point a couple of years back where we were getting close to a 25% idleness in our facilities, and that was causing us problems, and we testified to those at great length in the last couple of years. We've gotten the idleness rate down to about 17-18%, and that makes a big difference. Keeping dangerous offenders constructively occupied in our facilities, whether it's just swinging a mop or whether it's going to school or participating in chemical dependency treatment or sex offender treatment, those are things that contribute to a safer environment for not only the offenders, but certainly for the staff that have to work in those facilities.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? There's no further business before the committee, but before we go, these budget books, if you could leave them with the committee. You are free to take them, but just make sure we get them back because we have the potential of adding to this book as budget proposals come forward. So if you do take them, make sure you bring them back every committee here because there's a potential of additions. No other further business before the committee. The committee is adjourned.